I feel a direct line extending from that girl with her knees steepled beneath the hotel blankets to this person riding now in an errand chair. Hers was the duty to live out a mythical life in the actual world. Mine, to tell about it now. I didn't have the resources at 14, didn't know enough, hadn't been to the Anatolian mountain the Greeks call Olympus and the Turks Yuladag, just like the soft drink. I hadn't gotten old enough to realize that living sends a person not into the future, but back into the past, to childhood and before birth, finally, to commune with the dead. You get older, you puff on the stairs, you enter the body of your father. From there, it's only a quick jump to your grandparents, and then, before you know it, you're time traveling. In this life, we grow backwards. It's always the gray-haired tourists on Italian buses who can tell you something about the Etruscans. In the end, it took Luce 2 weeks to make his determination about me. He scheduled an appointment with my parents for the following Monday. Milton had been jetting around during the 2 weeks, checking on his Hercules franchises. But on the Friday preceding the appointment, he flew back to New York. We spent the weekend spiritlessly sightseeing, assailed by unspoken anxieties. On Monday morning, my parents dropped me off at the New York Public Library while they went to see Dr. Luce. My father had dressed that morning with special care. Despite an outward show of tranquility, Milton was beset by an unaccustomed feeling of dread, and so armored himself in his most commanding clothes. Over his plump body, a charcoal pinstripe suit, around his bullfrog neck, a Countess Mara necktie, and in the buttonholes of his shirt sleeves, his lucky Greek drama cufflinks. Like our Acropolis nightlight, the cufflinks had come from Jackie Hallis's souvenir shop in Greektown. Milton wore them whenever he met with bank loan officers or auditors from the IRS. That Monday morning, however, he had trouble putting the cufflinks in. His hands were not steady enough. In exasperation, he asked Tessie to do it. "What's the matter?" she asked tenderly, but Milton snapped, "Just put the cufflinks in, will you?" He held out his arms, looking away, embarrassed by his body's weakness. Silently, Tessie inserted the links, tragedy in one sleeve, comedy in the other. As we came out of the hotel that morning, they glittered in the early morning sun, and under the influence of those two-sided accessories, what happened next took on contrasting tones. There was tragedy, certainly, in Milton's expression as they left me off at the library. During Milton's time away, his image of me had reverted to the girl I'd been a year earlier. Now he faced the real me again. He saw my ungainly movements as I climbed the library steps, the broadness of my shoulders inside my Papagallo coat. Watching from the cab, Milton came face to face with the essence of tragedy, which is something determined before you're born, something you can't escape or do anything about, no matter how hard you try. And Tessie, so used to feeling the world through her husband, saw that my problem was getting worse, was accelerating. Their hearts were wrung with anguish. The anguish of having children, a vulnerability as astonishing as the capacity for love that parenthood brings, in a cufflink set all its own. But now the cab was driving away. Milton was wiping his brow with his handkerchief, and the grinning face in his right sleeve came into view, for there was a comic aspect to events that day, too. There was comedy in the way Milton, while still worrying about me, kept one eye on the rocketing taxi meter. At the clinic, there was comedy in the way Tessie, idly picking up a waiting room magazine, found herself reading about the juvenile sexual rehearsal play of Rhesus Monkeys. There was even a brand of harsh satire in my parents' quest itself, because it typified the American belief that everything can be solved by doctors. All this comedy, however, is retrospective. As Milton and Tessie prepared to see Dr. Luce, a hot foam was rising in their stomachs. Milton was thinking back to his early Navy days, to his time in the landing craft. This was just like that. Any minute the door was going to drop away, and they would have to plunge into the churning night surf. In his office, Luce got straight to the point. "Let me review the facts of your daughter's case," he said. Tessie noted the change at once. Daughter. He had said daughter. The sexologist was looking reassuringly medical that morning. Over his cashmere turtleneck, he wore an actual white coat. In his hand, he held a sketch pad. His ballpoint pen bore the name of a pharmaceutical company. The blinds were drawn, the light low. The couples in the Mughal miniatures had modestly covered themselves in shadow. Sitting in his designer chair with tomes and journals rising behind him, Dr. Luce appeared serious, full of expertise, as was his speech. "What I'm drawing here," he began, "are the fetal genital structures. In other words, this is what the baby's genitals look like in the womb, in the first few weeks after conception. Male or female, it's all the same. These two circles here are what we call the all-purpose gonads. This little squiggle here is a Wolfian duct, and this other squiggle is a Mullerian duct. Okay? The thing to keep in mind is that everybody starts out like this. We're all born with potential boy parts and girl parts. You, Mr. Stephanides, Mrs. Stephanides, me, everybody. Now," he started drawing again, "as the fetus develops in the womb, what happens is that hormones and enzymes are released. Let's make them arrows. What do these hormones and enzymes do? Well, they turn these circles and squiggles into either boy parts or girl parts. See this circle, the all-purpose gonad? It can become either an ovary or a testis. And this squiggly Mullerian duct can either wither up," he scratched it out, "or grow into a uterus, fallopian tubes, and the inside of the vagina. This Wolfian duct can either wither away or grow into a seminal vesicle, epididymis, and vas deferens, depending on the hormonal and enzymatic influences." Luce looked up and smiled. "You don't have to worry about the terminology. The main thing to remember is this. Every baby has Mullerian structures, which are potential girl parts, and Wolfian structures, which are potential boy parts. Those are the internal genitalia. But the same thing goes for the external genitalia. A penis is just a very large clitoris. They grow from the same root." Dr. Luce stopped once more. He folded his hands. My parents, leaning forward in the chairs, waited. "As I explained, any determination of gender identity must take into account a host of factors. The most important, in your daughter's case," there it was again, confidently proclaimed, "is that she has been raised for 14 years as a girl, and indeed thinks of herself as female. Her interests, gestures, psychosexual makeup, all these are female. Are you with me so far?" Milton and Tessie nodded. "Due to her 5-alpha reductase deficiency, Callie's body does not respond to dehydrotestosterone. What this means is that in utero, she followed a primarily female line of development, especially in terms of the external genitalia. That, coupled with her being brought up as a girl, resulted in her thinking, acting, and looking like a girl. The problem came when she started to go through puberty. At puberty, the other androgen, testosterone, started to exert a strong effect. The simplest way to put it is like this. Callie is a girl who has a little too much male hormone. We want to correct that." Neither Milton nor Tessie said a word. They weren't following everything the doctor was saying, but as people do with doctors, they were attentive to his manner, trying to see how serious things were. Luce seemed optimistic, confident, and Tessie and Milton began to be filled with hope. "That's the biology. It's a very rare genetic condition, by the way. The only other populations where we know of this mutation expressing itself are in the Dominican Republic, Papua New Guinea, and southeastern Turkey. Not that far from the village your parents came from. About 300 miles, in fact." Luce removed his silver glasses. "Do you know of any family member who may have had a similar genital appearance to your daughters?"
"Not that we know of," said Milton.
"When did your parents immigrate?"
1922.
"Do you have any relatives still living in Turkey?"
"Not anymore."
Luce looked disappointed. He had one arm of his glasses in his mouth and was chewing on it. Possibly he was imagining what it would be like to discover a whole new population of carriers of the 5-alpha reductase mutation. He had to content himself with discovering me. He put his glasses back on. "The treatment I'd recommend for your daughter is twofold. First, hormone injections. Second, cosmetic surgery. The hormone treatments will initiate breast development and enhance her female secondary sex characteristics. The surgery will make Callie look exactly like the girl she feels herself to be. In fact, she will be that girl. Her outside and inside will conform. She will look like a normal girl. Nobody will be able to tell a thing, and then Callie can go on and enjoy her life. Milton's brow was still furrowed with concentration, but from his eyes there was light appearing, rays of relief. He turned toward Tessie and patted her leg. But in a timid, breaking voice, Tessie asked, "Will she be able to have children?" Luce paused only a second.
"I'm afraid not, Mrs. Stefanides. Callie will never menstruate."
"But she's been menstruating for a few months now," Tessie objected.
"I'm afraid that's impossible. Possibly there was some bleeding from another source."
Tessie's eyes filled with tears. She looked away.
"I just got a postcard from a former patient," Luce said consolingly. "She had a condition similar to your daughter's. She's married now. She and her husband adopted two kids, and they're as happy as can be. She plays in the Cleveland Orchestra, bassoon."
There was a silence until Milton asked,
"Is that it, doctor? You do this one surgery, and we can take her home?" "We may have to do additional surgery at a later date, but the immediate answer to your question is yes. After the procedure, she can go home."
"How long will she be in the hospital?"
"Only overnight."
It was not a difficult decision, especially as Luce had framed it. A single surgery and some injections would end the nightmare and give my parents back their daughter, their Calliope, intact. The same enticement that had led my grandparents to do the unthinkable now offered itself to Milton and Tessie. No one would know. No one would ever know. While my parents were being given a crash course in gonadogenesis, I, still officially Calliope, was doing some homework myself. In the reading room of the New York Public Library, I was looking up something in the dictionary. Dr. Luce was correct in thinking that his conversations with colleagues and medical students were over my head. I didn't know what 5-alpha reductase meant, or gynecomastia, or inguinal canal. But Luce had underestimated my abilities, too. He didn't take into consideration the rigorous curriculum at my prep school. He didn't allow for my excellent research and study skills. Most of all, he didn't factor in the power of my Latin teachers, Miss Berry and Miss Silber. So now, as my wallabies made squishing sounds between the reading tables, as a few men looked up from their books to see what was coming and then looked down, the world was no longer full of eyes. I heard Miss Berry's voice in my ear. "Infants, define this word for me. Hypospadias. Use your Greek or Latin roots." The little schoolgirl in my head wriggled in her desk, hand raised high. "Yes, Calliope," Miss Berry called on me. "Hypo, below or beneath, like hypodermic."
"Brilliant.
And spadias. Can anyone come to our poor muse's aid?" But in the classroom of my brain, no one could. So that was why I was here, because I knew that I had something below or beneath, but I didn't know what that something was. I had never seen such a big dictionary before. The Websters at the New York Public Library stood in the same relation to other dictionaries of my acquaintance as the Empire State Building did to other buildings. It was an ancient, medieval-looking thing, bound in brown leather that brought to mind a falconer's gauntlet. The pages were gilded like the Bibles. Flipping pages through the alphabet, past cantabile to aringo, past fandango to formicate, that's with an M, past hypertonia to hyposensitivity, and there it was, hypospadias. New Latin from Greek, man with hypospadias, from hypo plus probably from spadon, eunuch from span to tear, pluck, pull, draw, an abnormality of the penis in which the urethra opens on its undersurface, see synonyms at eunuch. I did as instructed and got eunuch 1, a castrated man, especially one of those who were employed as harem attendants or functionaries in certain Oriental courts, to a man whose testes have not developed, see synonyms at hermaphrodite. Following where the trail led, I finally reached hermaphrodite, one having the sex organs and many of the secondary sex characteristics of both male and female. 2, anything comprised of a combination of diverse or contradictory elements. See synonyms at monster. And that is where I stopped and looked up to see if anyone was watching. The vast reading room thrummed with silent energy. People thinking, writing. The painted ceiling bellied overhead like a sail. And down below, the green desk lamps glowed, illuminating faces bent over books. I was stooping over mine, my hair falling onto the pages, covering up the definition of myself. My lime green coat was hanging open. I had an appointment with Luce later in the day, and my hair was washed, my underpants fresh, my bladder was full, and I crossed my legs, putting off a trip to the bathroom. Fear was stabbing me. I longed to be held, caressed, and that was impossible. I laid my hand on the dictionary and looked at it. Slender, leaf-shaped, it had a braided rope ring on one finger, a gift from the object. The rope was getting dirty. I looked at my pretty hand, and then pulled it away and faced the word again. There it was, monster, in black and white, in a battered dictionary in a great city library. A venerable old book, the shape and size of a headstone, with yellowing pages that bore marks of the multitudes who had consulted them before me. There were pencil scrawls and ink stains, dried blood, snack crumbs, and the leather binding itself was secured to the lectern by a chain. Here was a book that contained the collected knowledge of the past while giving evidence of present social conditions. The chain suggested that some library visitors might take it upon themselves to see that the dictionary circulated. The dictionary contained every word in the English language, but the chain knew only a few. It knew thief and steal and maybe purloined. The chain spoke of poverty and mistrust and inequality and decadence. Callie herself was holding on to this chain now. She was tugging on it, winding it around her hand so that her fingers went white as she stared down at that word, monster. Still there, it had not moved, and she wasn't reading this word on the wall of her old bathroom stall. There was graffiti in Webster's, but the synonym wasn't part of it. The synonym was official, authoritative. It was the verdict that the culture gave on a person like her, monster. That was what she was. That was what Dr. Luce and his colleagues had been saying. It explained so much, really. It explained her mother crying in the next room. It explained the false cheer in Milton's voice. It explained why her parents had brought her to New York so that the doctors could work in secret. It explained the photographs, too. What did people do when they came upon Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster? They tried to get a picture. For a second, Callie saw herself that way, as a lumbering, shaggy creature pausing at the edge of woods, as a humped convolvulus rearing its dragon's head from an icy lake. Her eyes were filling now, making the prince swim, and she turned away and hurried out of the library. But the synonym pursued her. All the way out the door and down the steps between the stone lions, Webster's dictionary kept calling after her, "Monster! Monster!" The bright banners hanging from the tympanum proclaimed the word. The definition inserted itself into billboards and the ads on passing buses. On Fifth Avenue, a cab was pulling up. Her father jumped out, smiling and waving. When Callie saw him, her heart lifted. The voice of Webster stopped speaking in her head. Her father wouldn't be smiling like that unless the news from the doctor had been good. Callie laughed and sprinted down the library steps, almost tripping. Her emotions soared for the time it took her to reach the street, maybe 5 or 8 seconds. But coming closer to Milton, she learned something about medical reports. The more people smile, the worse the news. Milton grinned at her, perspiring in pinstripes. And once again, the tragedy cufflink glinted in the sun. They knew. Her parents knew she was a monster.
And yet here was Milton, opening the car door for her. Here was Tessie, inside, smiling as Callie climbed in. The cab took them to a restaurant, and soon the three of them were looking over menus and ordering food. Milton waited until the drinks were served. Then, somewhat formally, he began,
"Yeah, your mother and I had a little chat with the doctor this morning, as you are aware. The good news is you'll be back at home this week. You won't miss much school. Now for the bad news. Are you ready for the bad news, Cal?"
Milton's eyes were saying that the bad news was not all that bad.
"The bad news is you have to have a little operation. Very minor. Operation isn't really the right word. I think the doctor called it a procedure. They have to knock you out, and you have to stay overnight in the hospital. That's it. There'll be some pain, but they can give you painkillers for it."
With that, Milton rested. Tessie reached out and patted Callie's hand. "It'll be okay, honey," she said in a thickened voice. Her eyes were watery, red. "What kind of operation?" Callie asked her father.
"Just a little cosmetic procedure, like getting a mole removed." He reached out and playfully caught Callie's nose between his knuckles. "Or getting your nose fixed."
Callie pulled her head away, angry. "Don't do that."
"Sorry," said Milton. He cleared his throat, blinking.
"What's wrong with me?" Calliope asked, and now her voice broke. Tears were running down her cheeks.
"What's wrong with me, Daddy?"
Milton's face darkened. He swallowed hard. Callie waited for him to say the word, to quote Webster's. But he didn't. He only looked at her across the table, his head low, his eyes dark, warm, sad, and full of love. There was so much love in Milton's eyes that it was impossible to look for truth.
"It's a hormonal thing, what you've got," he said. "I was always under the impression that men had male hormones and women had female hormones, but everybody has both, apparently."
Still, Callie waited.
"What you've got, see, is you've got a little too much of the male hormones and not quite enough of the female hormones. So what the doctor wants to do is give you a shot every now and then to get everything working right."
He didn't say the word. I didn't make him.
"It's a hormonal thing," Milton repeated. "In the grand scheme of things, no big deal."
Luce believed that a patient of my age was capable of understanding the essentials, and so that afternoon he did not mince words. In his mellow, pleasing, educated voice, looking directly into my eyes, Luce declared that I was a girl whose clitoris was merely larger than those of other girls. He drew the same charts for me as he had for my parents. When I pressed him on the details of my surgery, he said only this, "We're going to do an operation to finish your genitalia. They're not quite finished yet, and we want to finish them."
He never mentioned anything about hypospadias, and I began to hope that the word didn't apply to me. Maybe I had taken it out of context. Dr. Luce may have been referring to another patient. Webster's had said that hypospadias was an abnormality of the penis. But Dr. Luce was telling me that I had a clitoris. I understood that both these things grew out of the same fetal gonad, but that didn't matter. If I had a clitoris, and a specialist was telling me that I did, what could I be but a girl? The adolescent ego is a hazy thing, amorphous, cloud-like. It wasn't difficult to pour my identity into different vessels. In a sense, I was able to take whatever form was demanded of me. I only wanted to know the dimensions. Luce was providing them. My parents supported him. The prospect of having everything solved was wildly attractive to me, too. And while I lay on the chaise, I didn't ask myself where my feelings for the object fit in. I only wanted it all to be over. I wanted to go home and forget it had ever happened. So I listened to Luce quietly and made no objections. He explained the estrogen injections would induce my breasts to grow.
"You won't be Raquel Welch, but you won't be Twiggy either."
My facial hair would diminish. My voice would rise from tenor to alto. But when I asked if I would finally get my period, Dr. Luce was frank.
"No, you won't, ever. You won't be able to have a baby yourself, Callie. If you want to have a family, you'll have to adopt."
I received this news calmly. Having children wasn't something I thought much about at 14. There was a knock on the door, and the receptionist stuck her head in. "Sorry, Dr. Luce, but could I bother you a minute?"
"That depends on Callie," he smiled at me. "You mind taking a little break? I'll be right back."
"I don't mind."
"Sit there a few minutes and see if any other questions occur to you."
He left the room. While he was gone, I didn't think of any other questions. I sat in my chair not thinking anything at all. My mind was curiously blank. It was the blankness of obedience. With the unerring instinct of children, I had surmised what my parents wanted from me. They wanted me to stay the way I was, and this was what Dr. Luce now promised. I was brought out of my abstracted state by a salmon-colored cloud passing low in the sky. I got up and went to the window to look out at the river. I pressed my cheek against the glass to see as far south as possible where the skyscrapers rose. I told myself that I would live in New York when I grew up.
"This is the city for me," I said.
I had begun to cry again. I tried to stop, dabbing at my eyes. I wandered around the office and finally found myself in front of one of the Mughal miniatures. In the small ebony frame, two tiny figures were making love. Despite the exertion implied by their activity, their faces looked peaceful. Their expressions showed neither strain nor ecstasy. But of course the faces weren't the focal point. The geometry of the lovers' bodies, the graceful calligraphy of their limbs, led the eye straight to the fact of the genitalia. The woman's pubic hair was like a patch of evergreen against white snow, the man's member like a redwood sprouting from it. I looked. I looked once again to see how other people were made. As I looked, I didn't take sides. I understood both the urgency of the man and the pleasure of the woman. My mind was no longer blank. It was filling with a dark knowledge. I swung around. I wheeled and looked at Dr. Luce's desk. A file sat open there. He had left it when he hurried off. Preliminary study. Genetic XY, male, raised as female. The following illustrative case indicates that there is no preordained correspondence between genetic and genital structure or between masculine or feminine behavior and chromosomal status. Subject, Calliope Stephanides, interviewer, Peter Luce, M.D. Introductory data. The patient is 14 years old. She has lived as a female all her life. At birth, somatic appearance was of a penis so small as to appear to be a clitoris. The subject's XY karyotype was not discovered until puberty when she began to virilize. The girl's parents at first refused to believe the doctor who delivered the news and subsequently asked for two other opinions before coming to the Gender Identity Clinic and New York Hospital Clinic. During examination, undescended testes could be palpated. The penis was slightly hypospadiac, with the urethra opening on the underside. The girl has always sat to urinate like other girls. Blood tests confirmed an XY chromosomal status. In addition, blood tests revealed that the subject was suffering from 5-alpha reductase deficiency syndrome. An exploratory laparotomy was not performed. A family photograph, see case file, shows her at age 12. She appears to be a happy, healthy girl with no visible signs of tomboyishness despite her XY karyotype. First impression. The subject's facial expression, though somewhat stern at times, is overall pleasant and receptive with frequent smiling. The subject often casts her eyes downward in a modest or coy manner. She is feminine in her movements and gestures, and the slight gracelessness of her walk is in keeping with females of her generation. Though due to her height, some people may find the subject's gender, at first glance, somewhat indeterminate, any prolonged observation would result in a decision that she was indeed a girl. Her voice, in fact, has a soft, breathy quality. She inclines her head to listen when another person speaks and does not hold forth or assert her opinions in a bullying manner characteristic of males. She often makes humorous remarks. Family. The girl's parents are fairly typical Midwesterners of the World War II generation. The father identifies himself as a Republican. The mother is a friendly, intelligent, and caring person, perhaps slightly prone to depression or neuroses. She accedes to the subservient, wifely role typical of women of her generation. The father only came to the clinic twice, citing business obligations, but from those two meetings it is apparent that he is a dominating presence, a self-made man and former naval officer. In addition, the subject has been raised in the Greek Orthodox tradition with its strongly sex-defined roles. In general, the parents seem assimilationist and very all-American in their outlook, but the presence of this deeper ethnic identity should not be overlooked. Sexual function. The subject reports engaging in childhood sexual play with other children in every case in which she acted as the feminine partner, usually pulling up her dress and letting a boy simulate coition atop her. She experienced pleasurable erotosexual sensations by positioning herself by the water jets of a neighbor's swimming pool. She masturbated frequently from a young age. The subject has had no serious boyfriends. But this may be due to her attending an all-girls school or from a feeling of shame about her body. The subject is aware of the abnormal appearance of her genitalia and has gone to great lengths in the locker room and other communal dressing areas to avoid being seen naked. Nevertheless, she reports having had sexual intercourse, one time only, with the brother of her best friend, an experience she found painful, but which was successful from the point of view of teenage romantic exploration. Interview. The subject spoke in rapid bursts, clearly and articulately, but with the occasional breathlessness associated with anxiety. Speech patterning and characteristics appeared to be feminine in terms of oscillation of pitch and direct eye contact. She expresses sexual interest in males exclusively. Conclusion. In speech, mannerisms, and dress, the subject manifests a feminine gender identity and role, despite a contrary chromosomal status. It is clear by this that sex of rearing, rather than genetic determinants, plays a greater role in the establishment of gender identity. As the girl's gender identity was firmly established as female at the time her condition was discovered, a decision to implement feminizing surgery along with corresponding hormonal treatments seems correct. To leave the genitals as they are today would expose her to all manner of humiliation. Though it is possible that the surgery may result in partial or total loss of erotosexual sensation, sexual pleasure is only one factor in a happy life. The ability to marry and pass as a normal woman in society are also important goals, both of which will not be possible without feminizing surgery and hormone treatment. Also, it is hoped that new methods of surgery will minimize the effects of erotosexual dysfunction brought about by surgeries in the past when feminizing surgery was in its infancy. That evening, when my mother and I got back to the hotel, Milton had a surprise, tickets to a Broadway musical. I acted excited, but later, after dinner, crawled into my parents' bed, claiming I was too tired to go.
"Too tired?" Milton said. "What do you mean you're too tired?"
"That's okay, honey," said Tessie. "You don't have to go."
"Supposed to be a good show, Cal."
"Is Ethel Merman in it?" I asked.
"No, smartass," Milton said, smiling. "Ethel Merman is not in it. She's not on Broadway right now, so we're seeing something with Carol Channing. She's pretty good, too. Why don't you come along?"
"No, thanks," I said.
"Okay, then. You're missing out."
They started to go. "Bye, honey," my mother said. Suddenly, I jumped out of bed and ran to Tessie, hugging her. "What's this for?" she asked. My eyes brimmed with tears. Tessie took them to be tears of relief at everything we'd been through. In the narrow entryway, carved from a former suite, cockeyed, dim, the two of us stood hugging and crying. When they were gone, I got my suitcase from the closet. Then, looking at the turquoise flowers, I exchanged it for my father's suitcase, a gray Samsonite. I left my skirts and my Fair Isle sweater in the dresser drawers. I packed only the darker garments, a blue crew neck, the alligator shirts, and my corduroys. The brassiere I abandoned, too. For the time being, I held on to my socks and panties, and I tossed in my toiletry case and tire. When I was finished, I searched in Milton's garment bag for the cash he'd hidden there. The wad was fairly large and came to nearly $300. It wasn't all Dr. Luce's fault. I had lied to him about many things. His decision was based on false data, but he had been false in turn. On a piece of stationery, I left a note for my parents. Dear Mom and Dad, I know you're only trying to do what's best for me, but I don't think anyone knows for sure what's best. I love you and don't want to be a problem, so I've decided to go away. I know you'll say I'm not a problem, but I know I am. If you want to know why I'm doing this, you should ask Dr. Luce, who is a big liar. I am not a girl. I'm a boy. That's what I found out today. So I'm going where no one knows me. Everyone in Grosse Pointe will talk when they find out. Sorry I took your money, Dad, but I promise to pay you back someday, with interest. Please don't worry about me. I will be all right. Despite its content, I signed this declaration to my parents. Callie. It was the last time I was ever their daughter. Go West, Young Man. Once again in Berlin, Estefanides lives among the Turks. I feel comfortable here in Schöneberg. The Turkish shops along Hauptstrasse are like those my father used to take me to. The food is the same, the dried figs, the halva, the stuffed grape leaves. The faces are the same, too, seamed, dark-eyed, significantly boned. Despite family history, I feel drawn to Turkey. I'd like to work in the embassy in Istanbul. I've put in a request to be transferred there. It would bring me full circle. Until that happens, I do my part this way. I watch the bread baker in the Döner restaurant downstairs. He bakes bread in a stone oven, like those they used to have in Smyrna. He uses a long-handled spatula to shift and retrieve the bread. All day long he works, 14-16 hours, with unflagging concentration, his sandals leaving prints in the flour dust on the floor. An artist of bread baking. Stefanides, an American, grandchild of Greeks, admires this Turkish immigrant to Germany, this Gastarbeiter, as he bakes bread on Hauptstrasse here in the year 2001. We're all made up of many parts, other halves, not just me. The bell on the door of Ed's barbershop in the Scranton bus station merrily rang. Ed, who had been reading the newspaper, lowered it to greet his next customer. There was a pause, and then Ed said, "What happened? You lose a bet?" Standing inside the door, but looking as though he might flee back out of it, was a teenage kid. Tall, stringy, and an odd mix, if ever Ed saw one. His hair was a hippie's and came down past his shoulders, but he was wearing a dark suit. The jacket was baggy and the trousers were too short, riding high above his chunky tan square-toed shoes. Even from across the shop, Ed detected a musty thrift store smell, yet the kid's suitcase was big and gray, a businessman's. "I'm just tired of the style," the kid answered. "You and me both," said Ed the barber. He directed me to a chair. I, the easily rechristened Cal Stefanides, teen runaway, set my suitcase down and hung my jacket on the rack. I walked across the room, concentrating as I did on walking like a boy. Like a stroke victim, I was having to relearn all the simple motor skills. As far as walking went, this wasn't too difficult. The time when Baker and Inglis girls had balanced books on their heads was long gone. The slight gracelessness of my walk, which Dr. Luce had commented on, predisposed me to join the graceless sex. My skeleton was a male's, with its higher center of gravity. It promoted a tidy forward thrust. It was my knees that gave me trouble. I had a tendency to walk knock-kneed, which made my hips sway and my back end twitch. I tried to keep my pelvis steady now. To walk like a boy, you let your shoulders sway, not your hips, and you kept your feet farther apart. All this I had learned in a day and a half on the road. I climbed into the chair, glad to stop moving. Ed, the barber, tied a paper bib around my neck. Next, he draped an apron over me. All the while, he was taking my measure and shaking his head. I never understood what it was with you young people and the long hair. Nearly ruined my business. I get mostly retired fellas in here. Guys who come in my shop for a haircut, they don't have any hair. He chuckled, but only briefly. Okay, so nowadays, the hairstyles are a little bit shorter. I think, good, maybe I can make a living. But no, now everyone wants to go unisex. They want to be shampooed. He leaned toward me suspicious. You don't want a shampoo, do you?
Just a haircut. He nodded, satisfied.
How do you want it?
Short, I ventured.
Short, short, he asked.
Short, I said, but not too short.
Okay. Short, but not too short. Good idea. See how the other half lives.
I froze, thinking he meant something by this, but he was only joking. As for himself, Ed kept a neat head. What hair he had was slicked back. He had a brutal, pugnacious face. His nostrils were dark and fiery as he labored around me, pumping up the chair and stropping his razor.
Your father let you keep your hair like this?
Up until now.
So the old man's finally straightening you out. Listen, you won't regret it. Women don't want a guy who looks like a girl. Don't believe what they tell you they want, a sensitive male. Bullshit!
The swearing, the straight razors, the shaving brushes, all these were my welcome to the masculine world. The barber had the football game on the TV. The calendar showed a vodka bottle and a pretty girl in a white fur bikini. I planted my feet on the waffle iron of the footrest while he swiveled me back and forth before the flashing mirrors.
Holy mackerel! When's the last time you had a haircut anyway?
Remember the moon landing?
Yeah, that's about right.
He turned me to face the mirror, and there she was for the last time in the silvered glass, Calliope. She still wasn't gone yet. She was like a captive spirit peeking out. Ed the barber put a comb in my long hair. He lifted it experimentally, making snipping sounds with his scissors. The blades weren't touching my hair. The snipping was only a kind of mental barbering, a limbering up. This gave me time for second thoughts. What was I doing? What if Dr. Luce was right? What if that girl in the mirror really was me? How did I think I could defect to the other side so easily? What did I know about boys, about men? I didn't even like them that much.
This is like taking down a tree, opined Ed. First you gotta go in and lop off the branches, then you chop down the trunk.
I closed my eyes. I refused to return Calliope's gaze any longer. I gripped the armrests and waited for the barber to do his work. But in the next second, the scissors clinked onto the shelf. With a buzz, the electric clippers switched on. They circled my head like bees. Again, Ed the barber lifted my hair with his comb, and I heard the buzzer dive in toward my head.
Here we go, he said.
My eyes were still closed, but I knew there was no going back now. The clippers raked across my scalp. I held firm. Hair fell away in strips.
I should charge you extra, said Ed.
Now I did open my eyes, alarmed about the cost.
How much is it? Don't worry, same price. This is my patriotic deed today. I'm making the world safe for democracy.
My grandparents had fled their home because of a war. Now, some 52 years later, I was fleeing myself. I felt that I was saving myself just as definitively. I was fleeing without much money in my pocket and under the alias of my new gender. A ship didn't carry me across the ocean. Instead, a series of cars conveyed me across a continent. I was becoming a new person, too, just like Lefty and Desdemona, and I didn't know what would happen to me in this new world to which I'd come. I was also scared. I had never been out on my own before. I didn't know how the world operated or how much things cost. From the Lockmore Hotel, I had taken a cab to the bus terminal, not knowing the way. At Port Authority, I wandered past the Thai shops and fast food stalls, looking for the ticket booths. When I found them,
I bought a ticket for a night bus to Chicago, paying the fare as far as Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is as much as I thought I could afford. The bums and druggies occupying the scoop benches looked me over, sometimes hissing or smacking their lips. They scared me, too. I nearly gave up the idea of running away. If I hurried, I could make it back to the hotel before Milton and Tessie returned from seeing Carol Channing. I sat in the waiting area, considering this, the edge of the Samsonite clamped between my knees as though any minute someone might try to snatch it away. I played out scenes in my head where I declared my intention of living as a boy and my parents at first protesting but then breaking down, accepted me. A policeman passed by. When he was gone, I went to sit next to a middle-aged woman hoping to be taken for her daughter. Over the loudspeaker, a voice announced that my bus was boarding. I looked up at the other passengers, the poor traveling by night. There was an aging cowboy carrying a duffel bag and a souvenir Louis Armstrong statuette. There were two Sri Lankan Catholic priests. There were no less than three overweight mothers loaded down with children and bedding, and a little man who turned out to be a horse jockey with cigarette wrinkles and brown teeth. They lined up to board the bus while the scene in my head began to go off on its own, to stop taking my directorial notes. Now Milton was shaking his head no, and Dr. Luce was putting on a surgical mask, and my schoolmates back in Grosse Pointe were pointing at me and laughing, their faces lit with malicious joy. In a trance of fear, dazed yet trembling, I proceeded onto the dock bus. For protection, I took a seat next to the middle-aged lady. The other passengers, accustomed to these night journeys, were already taking out thermoses and unwrapping sandwiches. The smell of fried chicken began to waft from the back seats. I was suddenly very hungry. I wished that I were back at the hotel ordering room service. I would have to get new clothes soon. I needed to look older and less like prey. I had to start dressing like a boy. The bus pulled out of Port Authority, and I watched, terrified at what I was doing, but unable to stop myself, as we made our way out of the city and through the long, yellow-lit, dizzy tunnel that led to New Jersey. Going underground, through the rock, with the filthy river bottom above us, and fish swimming in the black water on the other side of the curving tiles. At a Salvation Army outlet in Scranton, not far from the bus station, I went looking for a suit. I pretended I was shopping for my brother, though no one asked any questions. Male sizes baffled me. I held the jackets discreetly against me to see what might fit. Finally, I found a suit roughly my size. It was sturdy-looking in all weather. The label inside said, Durenmatt's Men's Clothiers, Pittsburgh. I took off my Papagallo. Checking to see if anyone was watching, I tried the jacket on. I didn't feel what a boy would feel. It wasn't like putting on your father's jacket and becoming a man. It was like being cold and having your date give you his jacket to wear. As it settled on my shoulders, the jacket felt big, warm, comforting, alien. And who was my date in this case? The football captain? No. My steady was the World War II vet, dead of heart disease. My guy was the Elk Lodge member who had moved to Texas. The suit was only part of my new identity. It was the haircut that mattered most. Now in the barbershop, Ed was going at me with a whisk brush. The bristles cast a powder in the air, and I closed my eyes. I felt myself being wheeled around again, and the barber said, "Okay, that's it." I opened my eyes. And in the mirror, I didn't see myself. Not the Mona Lisa with the enigmatic smile any longer, not the shy girl with the tangled black hair in her face, but instead, her fraternal twin brother. With the screen of my hair removed, the recent changes in my face were far more evident. My jaw looked squarer, broader, my neck thicker, with a bulge of Adam's apple in the center. It was unquestionably a male face, but the feelings inside that boy were still a girl's. To cut off your hair after a breakup was a feminine reaction. It was a way to start over, to renounce vanity, to spite love. I knew that I would never see the object again. Despite bigger problems, greater worries, it was heartbreak that seized me when I first saw my male face in the mirror. I thought, it's over. By cutting off my hair, I was punishing myself for loving someone so much. I was trying to be stronger. By the time I came out of Ed's barbershop, I was a new creation. The other people passing through the bus station, to the extent they noticed me at all, took me for a student at a nearby boarding school. A prep school kid, a touch arty, wearing an old man's suit and no doubt reading Camus or Kerouac. There was a kind of beatnik quality to the Duranmat suit. The trousers had a sharkskin sheen. Because of my height, I could pass for older than I was, 17, maybe 18. Under the suit was a crew-neck sweater. Under the sweater was an alligator shirt, two protective layers of parental money next to my skin, plus the golden wallabies on my feet. If anyone noticed me, they thought I was playing dress-up, as teenagers do. Inside these clothes, my heart was still beating like mad. I didn't know what to do next. Suddenly, I had to pay attention to things I'd never paid any attention to bus schedules and bus fares, to budgeting money, to worrying about money, to scanning a menu for the absolutely cheapest thing that would fill me up, which that day in Scranton turned out to be chili. I ate a bowl of it, stirring in multiple packets of crackers, and looked over the bus routes. The best thing to do, it being fall, was to head south or west for the winter, and because I didn't want to go south, I decided to go west. To California. Why not? I checked to see what the fare would be. As I feared, it was too much. Throughout the morning it had drizzled on and off, but now the clouds were breaking up. Across the desperate eatery, through the rain-greased windows, and beyond the access road that bounded a strip of sloping littered grass, ran the interstate. I watched the traffic whizzing along, feeling less hungry now, but still lonely and scared. The waitress came over and asked if I wanted coffee. Though I had never had a cup of coffee before, I said, yes. After she served it to me, I doctored it with two packets of creamer and four of sugar. When it tasted roughly like coffee ice cream, I drank it. From the terminal, buses were steadily pulling out, leaving gassy trails. Down on the highway, cars sped along. I wanted to take a shower. I wanted to lie down in clean sheets and go to sleep. I could get a motel room for $9.95, but I wanted to be farther away before I did that. I sat in the booth for a long time. I couldn't see my way to the next step. Finally, an idea occurred to me. Paying my bill, I left the bus terminal. I crossed the access road and shuffled down the slope. I set down my suitcase on the shoulder and, stepping out to face the oncoming traffic, tentatively stuck out my thumb. My parents had always cautioned me against hitchhiking. Sometimes Milton pointed out stories in the newspaper detailing the gruesome ends of co-eds who had made that mistake. My thumb was not very high in the air. Half of me was against the idea. Cars sped past. No one stopped. My reluctant thumb was shaking. I had miscalculated with Luce. I thought that after talking to me, he would decide that I was normal and leave me alone. But I was beginning to understand something about normality. Normality wasn't normal. It couldn't be. If normality were normal, everybody could leave it alone. They could sit back and let normality manifest itself. But people, and especially doctors, had doubts about normality. They weren't sure normality was up to the job. And so they felt inclined to give it a boost. As for my parents, I held them blameless. They were only trying to save me from humiliation, lovelessness, even death. I learned later that Dr. Luce had emphasized the medical risk in letting my condition go untreated. The gonadal tissue, as he referred to my undescended testes, often became cancerous in later years. I'm 41 now, however, and so far nothing has happened. A semi appeared around the bend, blowing black smoke from an upright exhaust pipe. In the window of the red cab, the driver's head was bouncing like the head of a doll on a spring. His face turned in my direction, and as the huge truck roared past, he engaged the brakes. The rear wheels of the cab smoked a little, squealed, and then 20 yards ahead of me, the truck was waiting. Lifting my suitcase with a wild excitement, I ran up to the truck. But when I reached it, I stopped. The door looked so high up. The huge vehicle sat rumbling, shuddering. I couldn't see the driver from my vantage point and stood paralyzed with indecision. Then suddenly, the trucker's face appeared in the window, startling me. He opened the door.
You coming up or what?
Coming, I said. The cab was not clean. He had been traveling for some time, and there were food containers and bottles strewn around.
Your job is to keep me awake, the trucker said.
When I didn't respond right away, he looked over at me. His eyes were red. Red, too, were the Fu Manchu mustache and the long sideburns.
"Just keep talking," he said.
"What do you want to talk about?"
"Fuck all if I know," he shouted angrily, but just as suddenly, "Indians. You know anything about Indians?"
"American Indians?"
"Yeah. I pick up a lot of Indians when I drive out west. They're some of the craziest motherfuckers I ever heard. They got all kinds of theories and shit."
"Like what?"
"Like some of them say they didn't come over the Bering Land Bridge. Are you familiar with the Bering Land Bridge? That's up there in Alaska, called the Bering Strait now. It's water. Little sliver of water between Alaska and Russia. Long time ago, though, it was land, and that's where the Indians came over from. From, like, China or Mongolia. Indians are really Orientals."
"I didn't know that," I said. I was feeling less scared now than before. The trucker was apparently taking me at face value.
"But some of these Indians I pick up, they say their people didn't come over the land bridge. They say they come from a lost island, like Atlantis."
"Join the club."
"You know what else they say?"
"What?"
"They say it was Indians wrote the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution."
As it turned out, he did most of the talking. I said very little, but my presence was enough to keep him awake. Talking about Indians reminded him about meteors. There was a meteor in Montana that the Indians considered sacred, and soon he was telling me about the celestial sights a trucker's life acquainted a person with. The shooting stars and comets and green rays.
"You ever seen a green ray?" he asked me.
"No."
"They say you can't take a picture of a green ray, but I got one. I always keep a camera in the cab in case I come across some mind-blowing shit like that. And one time, I saw this green ray, and I grabbed my camera, and I got it. I got the picture at home."
"What is a green ray?"
"It's the color the sun makes when it rises and sets. For 2 seconds, you can see it best in the mountains."
He took me as far as Ohio and let me off in front of a motel. I thanked him for the ride and carried my suitcase up to the office. Here the suit also came in useful, plus the expensive luggage. I didn't look like a runaway. The motel clerk may have had doubts about my age, but I laid money on the counter right away, and the key was forthcoming. After Ohio came Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska. I rode in station wagons, sports cars, rented vans. Single women never picked me up, only men or men with women. A pair of Dutch tourists stopped for me, complaining about the frigidity of American beer. And sometimes I got rides from couples who were fighting and tired of each other. In every case, people took me for the teenage boy I was every minute more conclusively becoming. Sophie Sassoon wasn't around to wax my mustache, so it began to fill in, a smudge above my upper lip. My voice continued to deepen. Every jolt in the road dropped my Adam's apple, another notch in my neck. If people asked, I told them I was on my way to California for my freshman year at college. I didn't know much about the world, but I knew something about colleges, or at least about homework, and so claimed that I was going to Stanford to live in a dorm. To be honest, my drivers weren't too suspicious. They didn't care one way or another. They had their own agendas. They were bored or lonely and wanted someone to talk to. Like a convert to a new religion, I overdid it at first. Somewhere near Gary, Indiana, I adopted a swagger. I rarely smiled. My expression throughout Illinois was the Clint Eastwood squint. It was all a bluff, but so was it on most men. We were all walking around, squinting at each other. My swagger wasn't that different from what lots of adolescent boys put on, trying to be manly. For that reason, it was convincing. Its very falseness made it credible. Now and then I fell out of character. Feeling something stuck to the bottom of my shoe, I kicked up my heel and looked back over my shoulder to see what it was, rather than crossing my leg in front of me and twisting up my shoe. I picked correct change from my open palm instead of my trouser pocket. Such slips made me panic, but needlessly, no one noticed. I was aided by that. As a rule, people don't notice much. It would be a lie to tell you I understood everything I was feeling. You don't, at 14. An instinct for self-preservation told me to run, and I was running. Dread pursued me. I missed my parents. I felt guilty for making them worry. Dr. Luce's report haunted me. At night, in various motels, I cried myself to sleep. Running away didn't make me feel any less of a monster. I saw ahead of me only humiliation and rejection, and I wept for my life. But in the mornings, I woke up feeling better. I left my motel room and went out to stand in the air of the world. I was young and, despite dread, full of animal spirits.